This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2012 here on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. An overdue redesign for America's most circulated daily, a mix of eclectic new titles, including the new edition of The Gentlewoman, plus music magazine veteran David Hepworth and Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck, choose their favorite reads. All that and a few more pages and spreads today on edition 4 of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Also on this edition of The Stack, we discuss the forgotten art of magazine display.
Any publisher coming to me and saying, look, can we try this? I would probably say, yes, let's try it. Because you honestly, you do not know the strength of your product until you put it on the news shelves and see what happens. If we went to a news agent and said, would you take this new publication, the chance? Oh, they'd say yes, because we've got to test it.
And we get a rundown of the World Newspaper Editors Congress from its most unlikely host city yet, Kiev.
Reporters don't work alone. They work with editors, and that is the unique quality of great journalism, and that's where the New York Times excels, is the editorial support that helps shape the story and helps the reporter understand the perspective they're coming from and the perspective that the company wants, that the newspaper wants to project. And it's just not possible for an individual to do that.
All that ahead from the heart of London, right here on The Stack. Hello and welcome to edition 4 of The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the best in printed matter from around the world. Well, newsstand shelves are heaving this weekend with a host of weighty fashion titles and style bibles jostling for space as women's fashion weeks clog up calendars around the world. While perusing local newsstands around Midori House, the heft and breadth of offer is bigger than ever, and just when you thought your coffee table couldn't support another magazine devoted to breaking the career of another fashion photographer, there's no doubt something new from Berlin or Shoreditch or Brooklyn serving just that purpose. We'll be looking at some of this autumn's fashion offers, but first, our guests joining us around the table here in Studio One. Now, Dave Hepworth is something of a magazine publishing legend here in the UK and was the editorial mind behind launches including Q, Empire, Mojo, and many more. Until recently, he was also the driving force behind the music title, The Word. Now, I guess maybe we should start. What happened to The Word? Many, many, many fans, of course. Much love.
Yeah, not enough.
Not enough fans or not enough advertising?
Well, yes. It had 9 years, which we, our glib response is, it's as long as the Beatles had, and they did okay. And we were hit by the kind of the perfect storm of the kind of the general recession, the challenges, which is the euphemism everybody talks about around print, and also the fact that the kind of core advertiser in that area is the music business.
Absolutely.
Is in some disarray, you could say. And so basically what happened is we're a small publishing company, Development Hell, and we published that and Mix Mag. And we got to the stage where we were looking at the plans for the next year and we thought it's just going to lose too much money.
Right.
And that simply doesn't make sense and it's going to threaten the other magazines.
Well, we have some other music titles that we're going to be talking about today. And also, our editor, Andrew Tuck, is around the table. Rather grim news. We're almost 6 years into it. I don't know if we've maybe got three to go, Andrew.
I'm hoping there's more than 3 years.
I always sort of thought when you get over the 5-year hump with a magazine, it can sort of run and run forever.
I hope we're more Stones than Beatles.
I hope so as well. I wanted to start though, as it's a Saturday, and something which made a little bit of actually a considerable amount of news. And Dave, you've got a copy in front of you. But USA Today went for a relaunch, and we've got two copies. USA Today of yore, as we remembered it, with this. Kind of digitized sort of version of the Globe, which sort of became sort of highly animated. USA Today, once upon a time, had a TV program. Andrew, that's the old edition. And Dave, you have a redesign which is kind of curious. With the Globe has just been replaced by a big it's a big blue blob.
And the date, which is the key thing that draws your attention, 9/17/12. And I suppose it appears to be less like a newspaper, doesn't it?
Yes.
Which I suppose is kind of inevitable because it's presumably less aimed at getting people to pick it up on a newsstand. I don't know.
And the big blue circle does look like a picture didn't print. You really think something's gone wrong there? That doesn't look correct.
Yeah, it ought to have something saying caption here halfway down, doesn't it?
But I wonder if the big date is because they have a problem that people don't realise it's almost a daily paper, you know, that people travelling internationally who see it, perhaps they actually think it's a weekly paper.
They don't
really engage with it.
Yes, it could be.
Definitely. I also feel, I know, David, what you think, but just the organisation graphically across the top. I mean, it does feel even more above and below the fold when we think about websites. And I just sort of think that organisation across the top. And it'd be interesting to see how that's also reflected online on their site as well.
Yes, I'm not up to speed with their site, so I couldn't say. But it's like every redesign, you know. It starts with there's a roll of drums and you open the curtain and then 3 months later it slowly changes, doesn't it? You know, because it responds to practical considerations absolutely all the time.
Just switch and do it.
I mean, Andrew, you've spent more than a little bit of time in the world of newspapers. Do you think that they've gone far enough, though? Because what's curious, though, is they haven't changed the format. So you've got a redesign, but it's still this hybrid. It feels a little bit like a Berliner format. It's not quite sort of broadsheet. It can obviously sit nicely with tabloids on the newsstand. And I'm wondering what your view is just graphically when you look at it. And it's actually interesting. I think you're on the money sections or the business pages. How they've used that big blob is now used black and white as well, an arrow sort of pointing up to the right. Economy in ascent. It's kind of odd how they've used that as a graphic device.
Well, the most extraordinary thing is, you say, it's an unusual kind of format for a newspaper. Again, I always, the USA Today, I always think of somebody reading on a flight. It feels like a real airplane newspaper, rather. So I wonder if that kind of, when you open it up, you're not having to spread your arms too far. You're not punching your neighbour in the mush with your fist as you open the paper.
I had a curious experience the other day, actually. I read The Guardian on paper, and I have not read a newspaper on paper in quite a while. I read the Times and things like that.
And how was that experience for you?
The iPad version. And I was reading a long feature of something that somebody had kept for me to read. And I have to say, I really enjoyed it. And actually, holding the newspaper in your hands was a kind of pleasing and a novel experience because I hadn't done it for a while.
I mean, how long ago did you migrate to reading it off of a tablet?
Well, I get the Times tablet version, so whenever they launched that, 18 months, 2 years ago or something like that. And now my habit of reading it is totally different. I read it in bed, which was never available to me, if I've been waiting for a newspaper to be delivered.
And
it's a very different thing.
And do you read it the night before, or are you...
Sometimes you wake in the middle of the night, you think, have they posted it yet?
Right.
So they're about 4 o'clock in the morning is I think, when they tend to do it.
Mm.
So I get up very early. So I read it early in the morning. That's when I read it. And I very much enjoy the experience. But I similarly enjoyed the quite novel experience of paper this weekend.
Sorry, go ahead.
I just want to quickly point out that for the sports section, the blue blob becomes red and he wears a hat. He wears a Stetson, not even a baseball cap.
Which sort of looks like, the Japanese flag gone cowboy, oddly.
Do they have rodeo coverage in their sports section? That could be it, couldn't it?
But also interesting that the news section is 8 pages and the feature section's 8 pages, and half of that is advertising, and they still do take very small ads in these newspapers. They're trying to do something very condensed as a kind of read, but it's not quite the comment things you'd think you'd find in a condensed read. It seems slightly inspired still by the web, which is, I think, always a mistake for a newspaper.
Mm. It's always it strikes me, USA Today has always struck me as a paper desperately trying to avoid being weighty.
Yeah.
Because they've achieved that.
they've certainly done that. And, when I pick up paper, I tend to want weight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Weightiness in terms of the density of the read and so forth, rather than actual volume.
Okay, well, it doesn't sound like either of you are going to be rushing out either if you to download the edition. And Andrew, I don't even know if we get it upstairs.
We have from today. We'll keep an eye on them for a couple of weeks anyway.
Don't they put it through under hotel room doors? Isn't that traditionally where
could certainly fit under any hotel room door, for sure. You're listening to The Stack here in London. We're back in a moment. Well, as everyone at this table knows, producing magazines is an arduous process. The final product takes commissioning, illustration, editing, sub-editing, more sub-editing, and fact-checking. But too often the whole process can be in vain if the title isn't correctly displayed at the newsstand. Bill Stalker is the CEO of MMS in London, a company that specializes in making sure publishing products get the displays they deserve. Monocle's Ben Jay recently caught up with Bill.
Retailers now are looking at their magazine range and thinking, every magazine on my shelving has got to take money. So whereas the old days, people, newsagents would put magazines on the shelf, say a monthly magazine, they may sell the odd one or two copies every third month. Those days have gone. So retailers are now looking at their product and analysing it, and they are putting more time and effort into titles which they feel are new and the sales are still rising. And it's a case that once they sample these magazines, a lot of them get hooked. Maybe not full-time purchasers, but they become part-time purchasers. And my business is built on relationships with both publisher and newsagents. The importance of a magazine display is to having the right number of copies in the right place at the right time. So therefore, through our local events appertaining to a certain subject, and I would suggest to newsagents that they ensure copies relating to that to the local activity are prominently displayed. France is obviously very, very good for magazines, fashion magazines, and they've got some very useful independent companies selling the product. Another good area apparently is Sweden for magazines, and the third one is probably Japan. A lot of magazines are coming out of Japan, and which is very difficult to get over here, but people are aware of them and they do actually ask for them. Retailers know that with this new influx of product, it's got to be displayed because so many, now I hate this word, but I'll use it, the punter is not aware of these a lot of these publications, so they've got to be prominently displayed. The newsagent has got to allow the purchaser to view the magazines, to have a look at the magazine, because no way are they going to spend £10 on a magazine on something they haven't really had a look at. So there again, another thing that's changing is newsagents are allowing the potential purchasers to view the magazine before purchasing. Never say no to a new title. We do direct delivery or specialist publications, and really any publisher coming to me and saying, look, can we try this, I would probably say yes, let's try it, because you honestly do not know the strength of your product until you put it on the news shelves and see what happens. And our relationship with the key players in London is such that they take, you know, if we went to a news agent and said, would you take this new publication, the chances are they'd say yes, because we've got to test it. A good magazine rack has got to be one where the shelf has got depth, i.e. it's got to be able to sort of take 10, 15 copies of a magazine. Some newsagents have probably got shelving, which is rather antiquated, where you may only be able to get two copies of a magazine, two or three copies on the shelf. Well, these can be sold, and then they don't get replenished because the newsagent doesn't realise they've gone. If the magazine is worth its salt, it will enjoy better sales as well. It just sort of gets into your blood, so to speak, and you think, this is a fantastic business, and I'm hooked, and still am hooked, and I like to think I've still got the same amount of enthusiasm now as I had many years ago.
Oh, he makes it all sound so easy. That was Bill Stalker, the founder of MMS, and that is a company which specializes in merchandising magazines. He was talking to our Ben Jay. You're listening to The Stack here in London. Now, David, as we were chatting to you at the top of the show, of course, you know, it would have been great if more people would have been able to maybe just, you know, not just, you know, buy the word, find the word. And, you know, is that part of the problem today? I mean, we have this ongoing discussion. It makes all of us spin when we go through any mainline station anywhere in the world, any airport. And, I think for a lot of people listening, maybe they don't know, but, you know, not unlike cornflakes or Coca-Cola in a grocery store, you know, there's a huge payola business. If you're a title of scale, people go, oh, it's amazing that, you know, your distribution is really incredible. It sort of showed up all over the world. It's like, what, do you think that happened by accident and for free?
Yeah, absolutely. retail display allowances and so forth.
Exactly. I mean, as much as we can talk about, you know, the threat of digital and you know, and of course what tablets do. I mean, you know, is there a big issue that, and it's not in every market, but is the chain broken in some places as well?
It's increasingly difficult because the greater your share in supermarkets is, the more you're going to be dealt with the way that supermarkets deal with people supplying them with cornflakes or whatever, which is they don't just make money out of the customer, they make money out of the supplier.
Yeah.
That's basically how it works. And they get massive footfall in those places, forgive me for lapsing into jargon. And so you get lots of people looking at your magazine. So you have to decide, do you want to pay for it? And it's a very, very difficult trade-off. You know, the days of the corner newsagent being the core of the business have gone. And, you know, they're not going to come back. So you have to deal with this kind of thing. It makes people tear their hair out. And, of course, magazine publishers always think, if I had greater visibility, everybody would buy my magazine. That's not necessarily the case at all. And magazine publishers always think that they can affect display. I think it's very hard to affect it. We had a case of this a week or so ago that Hello announced that they were moving category in the ABC, didn't they? They no longer wish to be a gossip magazine. They now wish to be a fashion and lifestyle magazine. So could they basically be put next to Grazia? And, you know, I went to buy one and it was just in exactly the same place it had always been, because it'll always be decided by some guy with a hangover.
Yeah, I mean, no matter...
emptying a box in the morning. Yeah, and probably knows as well as anybody.
Yeah, I mean, we've actually gone to developing pictograms here when Monocle arrives, literally showing people no matter where it goes in the world, not on like an in-flight safety card, you know, no words attached, this is actually where we would like to sit. But, you know, as you said, I mean, good luck to Hello. It could take them, you know, 5 years, a decade for them to sort it out. Andrew?
Well, I just think it's also fascinating that unless you're in those independents, you're being sold and retailed often by people who have no interest in the product. So there's somebody stocking shelves. They can't recommend anything to someone who comes in the shop. It's one of the few parts of, you know, retail where, you know, if you go to a good fashion store, or, you know, even to a big high street fashion store, and you say, I want a T-shirt, they'll say, so this floor, I know what colour would be good for you. They'll try and help. They'll try and steer you. You go into most branches of any chain of a newsagent, you say, you do even have the magazine. They won't even know whether they stock the magazine. Mm. They have no passion for the thing they're selling. And that's a depressing thing when you build a magazine, I'm sure you've found. You create this magazine that you're so proud of, and you're worried about the paper and the quality of the print. And then it gets being tossed on a shelf by someone who has no interest.
But you see, I think underneath that, that's quite good discipline. That's quite good for everybody, actually, to realise that outside the precious environs of the editorial place, it's something that has to appeal to a moron in a hurry. Yeah. You know, that's what selling magazines is about.
Already, when you say that, it's actually giving me panic. I think we're going to take a break. And you and I can run down the street and go and see if we should re-merchandise around the corner. You're listening to The Stack in London. We're back after this.
A careful attention to detail helps define the clothing that J.Crew makes. As head menswear designer Frank Malchins explains, creating the best products often means approaching the design process through an unconventional lens, bringing together the best materials in the world with bold, smart designs.
To us, it's always striving for the best. It's about fit and design and color and fabric, and about working with the best mills and factories in the world. And in men's, you have to be persistent and consistent. All these values get translated by being obsessive about details, whether it's replicating a cool vintage button for a work shirt or shaping the armhole of our Ludlow jacket. So we question all components of a garment, and even the amount of stitches per inch can make a huge difference.
J.Crew.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're talking to David Hepworth, a name which It's probably familiar to many of our listeners, very much a music veteran in the editor seat, and he has a few music titles. And we've brought some other things in as well. I'm, of course, joined by Andrew Tuck, our editor. David, you've got Uncut Magazine, and then you also have Mojo sitting in front of you. Both have CD cover mounts, but maybe for people who aren't familiar, maybe you want to start with Mojo. Where does that sit in the music title landscape, and then and what's Uncut's role, would you say?
Well, I don't know. Relatively nowadays, I think Mojo would probably be the market leader, and it was never launched as such. It was launched as the kind of older brother of Q, to be something for people to kind of graduate to in their 40s and 50s or whatever. You'd now find that it appeals to, I think, what they call new traditionalists, and so you know
that might be everyone around this table.
Old gimmers like me and young gimmers who kind of like things done in a certain way, you know. So Mojo has probably been the market leader. Uncut, is a bit of a me too with Mojo, but probably would describe itself as a slightly broader, does more about film and so forth. But what's interesting to me about these two covers is that I've got to go to Germany this week and do a presentation about Wither Music Media. And one of the things I was working on this weekend was I tried to do a list of these are the people you can put on the cover of a music magazine and these are the people you cannot put on the cover of a music magazine.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, because people like Nick Cave and the Smiths, you can put on the cover of music magazines forever because people will buy into that. People who like music magazines like people like Nick Cave, the Smiths, Tom Waits, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen and so forth. You cannot simply transfer popularity in the wider world into the context of a music magazine cover. If you put Adele on the cover of a music magazine, you will die like a louse in a Russian's beard. It doesn't matter how many records she sells. The people who like Adele don't particularly want to read about her. The people who like Coldplay don't particularly want to read about them. This has been one of the big learnings in the last 20 years of music magazines. And like people always say, the common complaint is, why do they have the Beatles one month and they have Noel Gallagher the following month? That's because it works. And if you get outside that very narrow band of people, you don't work. Whereas it used to work 30 years ago. 30 years ago, the hottest thing was the new thing. It's not anymore. The hottest thing tends to be the old thing that's associated with virtues that come from an earlier age. Mm. You could probably say the same thing about car magazines, actually. I've got friends in car magazines who say the same thing. It's heritage is what sells car magazines,
right,
rather than the new thing.
And Dave, when people open the spines of these magazines, what are they looking for? Are they looking for record reviews? Are they looking for in-depth interviews? Do you have any feeling about what it is that they have to deliver?
They'll tend to deliver. They're trying to deliver what appears to be comprehensive review sections, and comprehensive review section is an increasingly difficult thing to provide because there's more and more records all the time. But it is one of the ways that people will assess whether they got their value for money. Mm. Does it have this many pages?
And on that value for money issue, that both have a cover-mounted CD.
They do, and the Mojo one is an absolute classic because it's got a cover that looks a little bit like the Smiths, but basically it's indie classics done by slightly less well-known people than the Smiths. But that's the kind of thing.
I was going to say, if you buy Uncut, then you have Into Your Arms, 15 tracks from the month's best new albums. How essential is it today? You see these two titles, they have this, would it affect your sales? Would you drop by 8 or gain 25% by having or not having?
I don't think it would respond in that fashion, but I think it's increasingly about justifying the subscription offer. Mm. And so, with Word, we were very successful in selling subscriptions, more successful than we were on the newsstand. And we were commanding, £42 for a subscription, which is quite a lot. You know, a lot of magazines are damn nearly giving away subscriptions in order to get you there. And so if they can say we have a CD on every issue, they're saying that's part of the offering when you decide to get out your credit card.
Now, we're CD fans around here, but what does it say about the demographic that they're reaching? That, in fact, they're CDs. That they're not saying, here's 5 tracks you can download on off this.
What it says is that the download option, which people talk about, and obviously people are always saying you ought to do that, it wouldn't work as well as the CD because the CD is just, it's a benefit. I've got it in my hand, you know what I mean? Whether I do anything with it or not. What we found with Word was that half the readership loved the CD, the other half
really didn't care about it very much. But you're kind of stuck with it.
I was at the Independent on Sunday newspaper when we had a cover-mounted sample from Oasis many years ago, and we managed to sell, I think, a ridiculous amount of newspapers that Sunday, another 150,000 newspapers or something. But every single one of those readers abandoned us the following Sunday when we didn't have a cover-mounted CD. There was literally no stick. They were the most promiscuous bunch of herd of readers you've ever seen. And they were just charging around on a Sunday to whichever newspaper had the best gift. And there was no, in the end, there was no benefit from doing it.
Well, of course, various acts did very well a few years ago out of taking major national newspapers for an absolute fortune. Prince notably did this with put his whole album on the Mail on Sunday, didn't he?
Yeah.
And got more money than he would have got if he put it in the declining number of record shops. It had no benefit from the Mail on Sunday whatsoever, apart from that week.
Now, it's interesting how you talked about that there's, a drawer full of maybe two dozen different acts you can put on a cover. I mean, how often, though, in this genre can a new act creep in and then become part of the classics? Is it probably like one a year?
Hardly ever at the moment.
Really?
If you gave a music magazine you take big stars like Lady Gaga.
Right.
You say to a music magazine editor, all right, you can either have Morrissey or you can have Lady Gaga. They're all going to take Morrissey. Doesn't matter how many stadia Lady Gaga fills, because they know what works with their constituency.
Mm. And hence Mojo, this cover with Morrissey with his hair looking higher than ever.
Yes.
And it's funny when you look through Uncut, lots of the pictures, it says taken in 1970, in 1969. Even the photography is from a time long past.
But it's really interesting. I actually got out a box of old magazines recently. I was trying to clear some space at home. I'm sure you've had this problem. What do? So I'm finding old rock magazines from the 70s. And I used to, the Zigzag and so forth, the Enemy or whatever. And I used to squirrel these things away, thinking the material in these papers and magazines will not be here in the future. It will disappear. Not true. It proved to be far more around now than it was then. So you got the guys who took those pictures in 1972. They're making a fortune out of them now. They didn't then.
You mentioned that you're off to a congress in Germany. We headed over to Eastern Europe recently to a conference as well. We're going to head to Kiev after this. Kiev was perhaps a curious venue for the 64th World Newspaper Editors' Congress. The Ukraine is not known as a country with a reputation for free speech. Since the election of President Viktor Yanukovych 2 years ago, opposition parties have had little access to television, rising numbers of journalists have been attacked, and censorship has increased. Freedom of the press was, perhaps unsurprisingly, high on the agenda in Kiev. And amid the protests, there was also time for a few serious debates on the future of an industry that is still trying to find its way in the digital age. The Stack sent Adrian Craddock to Kiev to find out more.
It's break time at the 63rd World Newspaper Congress in Kiev, and the audience is enjoying some traditional Ukrainian folk dancing. But just an hour earlier, the mood wasn't so jovial.
Незважаючи на непростий радянський спадок, молодий вік.
One of the draw cards of the opening ceremony was a speech from Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. I call on journalists to maintain a high level of ethical standards and uphold the principles of being objective, he says. As he talks, some of Ukraine's most prominent journalists stand with placards that read, "Stop censorship." Reporters Without Borders ranks Ukraine's freedom of speech as 116th out of 179 countries, with many journalists often complaining of intimidation from the government. It's appropriate, then, that as the speech continues, the president's security begin forcibly taking placards out of the protesters' hands. One of them is Mustafa Nayem, a reporter from the Ukrainian television channel TVI.
You should understand one thing. In our government now, those guys are from 90s. Those guys from the streets, and they don't understand the language of words. They understand only the language of action. You know, I saw the president who was saying about freedom of speech, about freedom of media, and I don't think they will be changed so easy as we want or we hope. The problem is not in one guy, I mean, in a college. It's a problem of system, problem of this party.
The World Newspaper Congress is hosted by a different city each year. The event in Kiev is designed to bring attention to the conditions that many Eastern European journalists operate under. Jacob Matthews is the president of the World Association of Newspapers, the body behind the Congress.
Oh, there were a lot of problems in the beginning, but the local association was able to convince the authorities that it is important for the region. We are hoping that at least we've made an impact here with our presence, and nearly 900 to 950 delegates are here. The fact that they came to learn about the region itself is a big thing.
Miguel Forbes, president of television and licensing at Forbes Incorporated, was at the conference in time for the launch of the brand's new Ukrainian web outlet. Miguel says he's confident the site will be allowed a free voice.
We wouldn't publish here if we didn't think there weren't an opportunity, you know. And our experience thus far has been very positive. You know, I mean, there's other markets that are very difficult. And, you know, I mean, obviously we're not publishing in North Korea, you know. But this is a market where we think that, you know, Western global media has a free voice.
Aside from focusing on press freedom, the Congress also aims to help find solutions to the many challenges facing the publishing industry. One of the key speakers is Michael Golden, the vice chairman of the New York Times Company, which is riding high on increased circulation and paid digital subscriptions. Mr. Golden says great journalism will keep papers like the Times relevant long into the future.
Reporters don't work alone. They work with editors, and that is the unique quality of great journalism, and that's where the New York Times excels, is the editorial support that helps shape the story and helps the reporter understand the perspective they're coming from and the perspective that the company wants, that the newspaper wants to project. And that's, it's just not possible for an individual to do that. Mm-hmm. I think the future of print will be smaller papers, and at some point it will be fewer days of the week. So I think that is the future. I don't think it's coming as quickly now as to say that it's a trend. But what's important is to have that digital relationship, and that's what I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. If that's in place, then you can look and see, all right, what happens with the print product. Where I think the greatest danger is in reducing the print product before you have that digital relationship firmly established.
On the other side of the US, the Seattle Times isn't in such good shape. It's not for lack of quality content. The paper this year took out a Pulitzer Prize for its investigative journalism. For executive editor David Boardman, the key lies in monetizing the paper's growing readership.
Financially, I mean, we certainly are struggling in some regards, like many other newspapers in America are. We had a very advertising based business model that was very successful for us for many years. We're optimistic, though, in the case, in the sense that we have grown our readership, where there are more people reading our content today than there has ever been. Our market share remains what it has been, which is at 70%. We are by far the most highly trafficked local website in Seattle. By every measure, people are engaging with us. We believe with tremendous conviction that there's a business to be had out of that. We just have to change the revenue streams and probably create many smaller streams to replace the one big fire hose that we used to have, which was advertising and particularly classified advertising. That's changed forever, and we're adjusting to that.
While business might look down for papers like the Seattle Times, the Congress speakers list is full of industry veterans who've steered their publications out of economic trouble. Dr. Raina Esser is the CEO of Die Zeit. Nowadays, Die Zeit is one of Germany's most profitable and celebrated broadsheets. But as he told me, in the mid-90s, the masthead was at risk.
The situation was pretty dramatic, with circulation going down over more than 10 years, advertising going down, and we incurred pretty heavy losses for a couple of years. The reason was pretty easy. The Zeit used to be very successful, and then all on a sudden the heroes had forgotten to bring in new people, and marketing was something you were not allowed to pronounce within the walls of Die Zeit. So new people had to be brought in, new editors, new ideas, marketing, new energy.
Perhaps the most compelling view on the future of printed newspapers comes from Martin Jonsson, the deputy editor-in-chief of Swedish daily Svenska Dagbladet. Its revolutionary structure divides the editorial team into fast and slow newsrooms. One tackles breaking stories, the other devotes weeks on more considered pieces that set the agenda. Supposedly, the system works so well, he knows what exposés, scoops and features will be on the paper's front page up to 10 days in advance.
It's an untraditional way of doing newspaper because we're so used to the old mythology of the newsroom where you rush towards the deadline with the script in your hand and saying, print this. But that's totally irrelevant today because even if you rush into the final seconds of deadline, it's still old news when it reaches the reader because the news are online. So we have to think differently on what the print newspaper should be. You can compare with the phone industry where people don't have landlines anymore because they realize, they look at their old phones at home and say, I don't use it. No one calls on it. Everyone calls on the mobile. So you cancel the subscription to the landline. If newspapers become like that you look at the newspaper, you look at front page and say, I know this already. I know everyone and everything in this front page already. Then why should you pay for it? You shouldn't really. So instead you have to have more unique content, more relevant stories, working much more on setting today's agenda instead of reporting yesterday's news. It's not rocket science.
Until next year's Congress, the survival of the printed newspaper industry will lie in finding a way to keep the landline appealing. For Monocle in Kiev, I'm Adrian Craddock.
And that was the World Newspaper Editors Congress in Kiev, as you heard there. I mean, to both of you, a lot of interesting things there. You know, you've got Svenska Dagbladet talking about fast and slow newsrooms. You have Die Zeit really reinventing themselves, which is quite interesting because Die Zeit only comes out once a week. I mean, it's just this big, massive beast of a newspaper. And then you have, Michael Gold from the New York Times talking about a slimmed down newspaper, a smaller newspaper, and a change in frequency. So, I'll start with you, David. I mean, are you encouraged by any of those things that you hear there?
I hear lots of, these people, they know what they're talking about, and they've got huge experience. And I hear lots of brave words from all kinds of newspaper groups. And then I get on the tube, like I did this morning, and I conduct the only audit that's worth a light in the press, is just count down your carriage how many people have got a paid-for newspaper. It was two this morning. And the rest is, the Metro giving away free, or, people, I suppose, possibly might be reading them on their tablet. I don't think they were. And I was particularly interested in that comment at the end from the Swedish publisher, talking about, we've got to have compelling content that makes people go out and buy our newspaper. And I was trying to think, yes, what are the live examples of that actually having occurred? The only one I could think of was the Telegraph with the MP's expenses. Is that the case? I think that really did drive circulation, didn't it, for quite a while? Because it was all local news, wasn't it? Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. But I think also, that if you cover big events like the Olympics, you have a slight bounce for those, especially for the British newspapers who were covering. People wanted to read more about sport, and more, they were happier picking up the printed newspaper in the morning. They wanted some reflection. So I think from events like that, you get a slight lift. I thought it was interesting hearing the Seattle Times, though, because I fear that that's where most newspapers are, where you're quite happy to sit at a media conference and say, we don't kind of know what's going on, to be honest. You know, we know that this has stopped. We know that, as he described it, this giant fire hose of advertising has been switched off. But where are all these other revenue streams? We're still looking. Now, we know that we've got lots of people coming to our site, and you know, that's a great thing that you've got these big numbers, but they don't actually deliver anything. They don't deliver revenue streams in advertising. Mm-hmm. People aren't buying your newspapers. And in the end, it doesn't matter if you've got a billion people. Unless you've got the cash to break some stories, to send some journalists out on the road, then you've got nothing. And you're much better off actually with a smaller readership, a number of page clicks, whatever, if those people are then spending some money with you and then bringing in some advertising.
Just before we go to break, David, I wanted to ask, you know, you started off this program talking about your subscription to The Times here. And this has obviously been a very big story in the UK, that The Times does have a paywall. Is that where Mr. Seattle Times, everyone's going to have to end up there? As much as many people, we've had Mr. Russ Bridger from The Guardian, of course, saying that, you know, we are committed to, having, a free and open press and our website's going to be wide open. Does someone like that and other publishers eventually eat the words?
I don't know, because they're always going to have the BBC in this country as a huge issue, which is the free news provider that we all pay for in our licence fee. So they're always going to use that as the argument. You know, if we put a paywall around The Guardian, all people are going to do is go over there and get it from the BBC. I don't exactly know what's going to be the outcome. You know, I keep trying to think back to the days when newspapers were compelling purchases. Because if you didn't pick them up, you didn't get that news at all. You didn't get the football results and all that kind of stuff. That's not going to come back.
No, I think the interesting discussion is what a newspaper becomes. And again, I think there's too much theorising about that at the moment. There's this idea that the newspaper just becomes a place for comment or reviews and you don't do breaking news. But the reality is that, as you said, the compunction to pick that up, the compelling reason to pick up the paper is always something a bit breaking news on the front page.
I think this is the topic which is going to run and run, hopefully, on this programme. You're listening to The Stack. We're back in a moment.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Malchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. You're like the details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with David Hepworth and Andrew Tuck and me, Tyler Brulé. I just wanted to go back to this one comment a little bit early on from the World Newspaper Editors Congress, and we heard from that gentleman from the Svenska Dagbladet who was talking about the fast and slow newsroom. Do you think the fast and slow newsroom, David, was an invention of editors and journalists and sub-editors sitting there, or do you think that's a management consultancy that came in?
It's probably a bit of both, isn't it? You know, the thing I find missing in the whole debate is, I can pick up, go to websites or whatever, and I find very clever people in newspapers telling me what the future is going to be like. Mm. And I think, if you're that confident, go off and do it, matey. You know what I mean? If you think there's a future in hyperlocal or whatever it is, there's nothing stopping you doing it. Because the newspaper business was built by hugely ambitious, mad entrepreneurs, greedy for money and power. you know, the future of media is not going to be built by media consultants or professors in universities. Mm. It won't be done.
I mean, Andrew, you've no doubt seen enough consultants come through various newspapers you worked at and other publishing organizations. Again, do you think this is something which it really was, you know, an upsurge from the editorial floor, or was this, again, you know, the consultants who parachuted into the executive level?
It sounds like someone who's been sent along with a way of kind of saving some money and trying to change the beast. I had a really awful experience on a newspaper where, with a consultant, the consultant said to me, he'd kind of worked out how long on the magazine we were spending doing different tasks, and he said, you know, you seem to spend a large amount of money on subbing and on editing copy. And I was, yeah, that's right. And he said, I think that you should stop doing that. I think you should stop subbing the copy. And I was like, okay, explain to me why. He said, because I think that you just need to commission writers who supply perfect copy. And then you just print that. You don't need to be going through all these processes of subbing. And when you have a consultant coming like that, where you're literally explaining to them, well, what about if there's a legal issue? Well, you shouldn't use that writer then. Okay, this is almost unbelievable. And, you know, and I also went through a process where there was like the idea of the hub, where every journalist was going to be doing Photoshop, laying out the pages.
And that's what you do upstairs, isn't it?
Well, I'm all for being multidisciplinary, but, you know, but it was painful watching somebody who was an amazing writer, who is perhaps in their 60s, being told, you're now going to learn page layout and you'll be laying out your own column and subbing it and writing the headline. And you forget that, again, it's the thing we've always come back to here. Why then don't people buy newspapers and magazines? It's because they're rubbish. It's because, you know, they've got rid of the sub-editor and the headline isn't as good as it was and the poor writer's doing 50 things. That's what the consultant needs to look at. How do you start raising the quality of what you're doing and, you know, just making it something that's really undeniably good?
Or maybe the bigger issue is that you need good editors, and certainly people sitting in boardrooms shouldn't be bloody hiring consultants to begin with and spending a little bit more hiring.
Well, you know what a consultant is going to tell you straight
Pretty
away.
Much,
I could
yeah.
write a consultant's report, and actually, in a way, it kind of makes sense because, you know, the magazine business is still broadly done the way it was done 40 years ago.
Hmm.
The radio business is not done the same way. The TV business is not
just
done
listen,
the same way.
Exactly.
And so there have to be some changes.
Yeah.
But they'll be invented by people on the inside, not by consultants.
A little bit earlier, we were talking about music magazines. We were looking at Uncut Mojo. At the top of the program, I said that we would be looking at The Gentlewoman. You've got a copy of that, Dave. Andrew, you've got its slightly older brother, the autumn issue of Fantastic Man. Dave, just first impressions. You're having a good giggle.
It's hilarious.
You're liking Angela Lansbury on the front cover.
Yes, it looks like something I might. And this is not being disrespectful at all, but if I'd been in the Harley Street waiting room in 1956, I would have picked up this, you know, probably with a light dusting of face powder.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's got the feeling of kind of Mrs. Miniver and the 1950s about it, which is no doubt what they were seeking to achieve, certainly on the cover. I don't know. Is it the kind of thing I have to do, take home to my wife and just very diplomatically say, this is aimed at you,
well,
or not?
It's interesting because you know, the Gentlewoman has certainly been something of a darling in the whole, you know, fashion press arena, and I think they've always been sort of slightly, you know, arch in terms of their cover choices. And I almost wonder, you know, does it represent your reference to sort of, you know, a Harley Street waiting room? You know, is that also, you know, a part of where maybe that part of fashion journalism or fashion publishing also needs to go, like music, and, you know, in a way as well?
Go older.
Potentially.
Well, you've always got the problem that in their heads, when people buy a fashion magazine, they're 23 years old and, you know, rake thin.
Yeah. Andrew, before we go to maybe we won't even get to Fantastic Man this program, but what did you make of The Gentlewoman? This type of cover, sort of the Elizabeth Arden.
Elizabeth Arden, that's
it. It is, isn't it? Is that Elizabeth Arden kind of pink?
Coaty.
Yeah.
I think the trick that The Gentlewoman does very well is, you know, that it knows it's slightly humorous.
Right.
So it's a little bit self-spoofing sometimes. But I think that the same as Fantastic Man, they've just created a market that they don't, in a way, have to worry who's on the cover. It's their choice, it's their curation that
right.
people come for. And I think it's just great looking at Fantastic Man, you know, that it's fat and it's got several paper stocks. And they occupy a part of that shelf where there's so many fashion magazines that when you flick through them, you're done in 10 seconds. It's, you know, it's just gratuitous, terrible photography that's only for the sake of a photographer. But the thing about Fantastic Man, they do care about you reading stuff as well. And they have a style of doing it that's very there. So you read, you know, four or five paragraphs and you know it's a Fantastic Man story. And I think that whatever your market is, if you're that confident about your identity, then it works.
Mm. Just before we wrap up, and I wanted to, I would imagine if you've probably got a favorite newsstand, or does everything get delivered to your office? But you know, what does your stack look like? I mean, you know, what do you still get excited about when you go down to the newsstand? What do you want to pick up?
And I increasingly, it's subscription for me, actually. I have to confess, I don't go to the newsstand very often. I subscribe to quite a few titles, and they tend to be high-frequency titles. And I read them partly on paper and partly in the iPad version. And there's never been a time in my life when I've done that more than I do it now.
And how do you discover the new then? Because isn't that the important thing?
Well,
of going to Grays? And you know, it has, I'm not saying that every merchandising company gets it right, but you know, it would be wonderful that, you know, if every newsstand, you know, did have, okay, not just it's just out, but here is a place, we've got a bit of a buffet set up for you, and you can sort of go and pick and choose. So
yeah, well, I don't do it anything like as much as I ought to, and I will
ought to, and also used to as well.
Well, it used to years ago, because that was the only way there was a bunch of American magazines you used to pick up every week, because if you didn't pick up Entertainment Weekly and Rolling Stone and all those kind of things, you didn't know about any of that
stuff. It was amazing. I mean,
nowadays, you can find it, it's online.
It's funny to think back to the days of, I guess, early 90s, being in magazines in London, when you would have your New York office or correspondent, and they would send over their Entertainment Weekly, and it was just, you know, everyone fought for it.
Yes, because all the information was not anywhere else.
Yeah.
Now it's absolutely everywhere. You can't avoid it, that kind of thing.
I think it only exists here probably, Andrew, a little bit with the Japanese magazines coming to the office.
Yeah, and like the kind of odd Spanish title and things that you kind of seize off each other's desks, because you know you can't find that information. But I think that, you know, that is a test of all magazines and newspapers, that you need to have content that's just not easily Googleable. You can't. It needs to be stuff that's really it's your comment, your opinion, that you're delivering something that's fresh.
Hmm. Just one more question on, you know, aside from, you know, what you're reading, you know, on your tablet and all of those types of things, what's on the horizon? Is there something now coming up after the word?
Not immediately. No, I don't. Our priority at the moment is Mixmag, and you know, which is in a market that is flourishing. The dance market is doing very well, and Mixmag's market leader, so it enjoys that advantage. And so I think that's what we're concentrating on for the moment.
Excellent. Andrew, I believe you have a November issue. It's I saw a couple of pages floating around upstairs.
There's a couple. There needs to be quite a few more in the next couple of days, I think.
Excellent. Dave Hepworth and Andrew Tuck, thanks very much for that. That brings us to the end of this fourth edition of The Stack. Today's show was produced by Don Trump and Adrian Craddock, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at 10 a.m. here in London. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, for me, here on a Saturday, I'm Tyler Brulé. Goodbye.